Gracie's father is dead. But I'm the father and the mother.
Excuse me, Harold, I have to say that this is the third tape, and it's March the 20th, 1978, in Frederick, Maryland, with Harold Weisberg, W-E-I-S-B-E-R-G.
I met the father and the mother while Philip was in Vietnam with the NPP. The father got killed in an electrical accident. He was an electrician. He was doing some moonlighting, and he got shot in a building.
They lived in New Orleans?
Metairie, which is a suburb of Jefferson Parish. And I went out there one night, I called them up, and they agreed to see me. I earned their confidence, and I showed them I wanted to take the court, and I said, I'll play everything back. And if you change your mind on anything, we'll erase it, and I'll show you it's erased. And if you want to correct anything or amplify anything, we'll do it. So they did. I knew more than I told them, because I had a copy of the juvenile report on Philip, who had run away from home several times. The father was celebrating the John Kennedy assassination by using the day off from work to go hunting. The father, apparently, the mother and father both seemed to be very nice people, but the mother was a very dominating woman. And I knew the stories about Philip not even being allowed to ride the bicycle except on the sidewalk where he lived. And that when he went to a dance, he was escorted by his father. This is the kind of home from which he came. Philip had been in the Civil Air Patrol cadets. Now, this story I was told by the mother, partly confirmed by the father, later confirmed by Philip, because after the father was killed, Philip could come back to Vietnam. The story of Bringier and the Warren Commission, and they're two different dates for it. They're close, August 2nd and August 5th, supposed to be the date that Oswald was at Bringier's store.
That's in 1963.
Yes.
In New Orleans.
In New Orleans, on Decatur Street. It was earlier, as I will explain. But it was important for Bringier not to date it any earlier than the second, because his story was that he suspected Oswald, didn't trust him. And his explanation for not trusting Oswald was that he was afraid that Oswald was trying to penetrate his organization. How you penetrate a one-man organization, I've never been able to figure out. But Bringier was the only one in the DRE, or the Student Cuban Director, in New Orleans. He was hardly a student. There was a raid on a small munitions depot in a private home off Pontchartrain Drive, I think it is, in St. Tammany's Parish on the other side of Lake Pontchartrain. And there were a lot of odds and ends of explosives there and things of that sort that the Cubans had brought in. The explanation of the raid is innocent. A neighbor caused it. I learned that in the course of my own investigation. He was afraid that he was going to blow up the whole part of the countryside. So, and he had a legitimate fear. They almost did. He called up the police after the Cubans were careless and started a brush fire that almost got to the house, which would have set all that stuff off. So the FBI had to conduct a raid. Of course, the word got around in New Orleans, some of the people at another camp. It was sort of a make-believe camp, but there were, I've forgotten now, whether 10 or 20 men there. I think 20. They had a vamoose. But Bringier's story is that because of the raid on the camp. He was afraid that Oswald was penetrating his organization, which consisted of himself only.
And Oswald had come in to Bringer's store and tried to show him the Marine manual?
Yes, said he would be glad to help him and things of that sort.
Yes.
He was an experienced man. Philip Geraci and another boy whose name escapes me at the moment were both there. And they apparently had a discussion with Oswald about blowing up bridges and things of that sort. At least that's their story, Philip's story.
Would you want to describe Philip for me, physically?
Philip was almost a diminutive boy. He was quiet, he wore glasses, dark hair. He may have about 5'8", 5'9", but he gave the impression of being smaller. He was not of large frame. He was sort of slim. He was not fat. Now, the raid was on July 31st. Bringer placed the date at August 2nd and at August 5th. And of course, this achieved some credibility, because it was on August, I think, the 8th, that he and Oswald had a fracas that didn't get precipitated. That was on Canal Street. The real problem is that it was the testimony of Philip Geraci that he saw Oswald and Bringer's the first time he went to Bringer's. There was a point in the deposition of Geraci where Lieber edited his question to change the meaning of the answer to make it appear that Geraci had been there only one time. He was there fairly often. He was there in May or June, because the mother told me it was right after the end of school. She had a dental appointment, and she drove Philip and this other boy down to that neighborhood where they were going to get some stuff for a CAP, usable as part of the CAP uniform, cadet uniform. Now, these are two good ways of remembering what it was, but the time does not hang on that. I got some receipts from the parents. Receipts for signed by Philip for the bonds he was getting from Bringer to sell. Receipts to Bringer for the money Philip gave him. And these were dated June and July. Early July. So you see, Bringer's story about the time is false. Philip, therefore, would have been a serious embarrassment to Bringer. But he was somehow taken by Bringer. I guess a little bit of romance about it. Philip tried to organize his youth version of a paramilitary organization. He called them the Marsh Marauders. He had a bunch of kids that go traipsing through the marshes, making on their engaged in a military operation. Boy-like.
About how old was he?
Junior in high school. About 15. Now, after Philip came back from Vietnam, I made a deal with Garrison that he wouldn't keep. But if he would leave Philip and the other young people to me, I'd give him everything I got. But I wanted him to leave him alone. After Philip's father died, and he came back from Vietnam, Garrison subpoenaed him three times and he never showed up. And of course, even subpoenaing him was a violation of his agreement with me. So I went down to New Orleans and I made a couple of deals. I bypassed Garrison and made a deal with Lou Ivan and Jim Alcock that if the kid would talk to me, they would leave the kid alone. And I would tell them anything they wanted to know. With that agreement, I went to the kid's lawyer, the family lawyer, who was William Cullen. She practiced law under her maiden name, and her husband was a lawyer who was a judge. His name was Louis Trent, T-R-E-N-T, and C-O-H-E-N. And I told her to have her husband, who was well acquainted with Garrison, just check it out, find out if I wasn't telling her the truth. And then I told her that I wanted to interview Philip in her presence. I wanted him to have the protection of the lawyer. I wasn't trying to pull any games on him. I thought the lawyer ought to know what I would be getting from this boy. I told her I fully expect to get what you don't know. So they agreed to that. It was on a Saturday afternoon at her home.
Who agreed to all of this?
The lawyer and the lawyer, Lillian Cohen, the lawyer. Mm-hmm. And she spoke to Philip's mother and to Philip. I did not expect the mother to show up, but the mother did.
And this was approximately what day? What year?
It would have been in warm weather in 1968. Mm. It was I don't know. Maybe around July. I don't really remember. I have records on it, of course you can't find out. The Trents lived in a nice old house on the canal side of Broadway, which was the main street uptown in the residential area, old house they fixed up well. And that's where we, Mrs. Cohen had an office there. The basement, and the desk, and the chairs, and that's where I interviewed Philip. Philip blurted out.
So you came in the evening?
No, daylight. It was about right after lunch on a Saturday afternoon. The Trents delayed going off on their boat to do this. They have a boat, as a lot of people in the world are doing, they enjoy boating. So, he blurted out many things, but the one thing that interested me most of all was the kidnapping. Philip, after he got out of high school, wanted to leave home. He and his father didn't get along at all, and he disliked his father. I remind you to come back to that. And he resented the fact that his mother smothered him at the very least. So he got a job in New Orleans. He was working in New Orleans when Ferry died. The night that Ferry died, which means, you know, the fact that Ferry's death was discovered before the middle of the day, but the story is the middle of the day. That night there came a knock on Philip's apartment or room, I forgot which it was. But, and there were two people, one of whom he knew. The one he knew was the sergeant who conducted the juvenile investigation at one time as Philip left home. His name was Bourne, B-O-U-R-N-E. The other one was Frederick S. O'Sullivan, a member of the Vice Squad. The New Orleans Police Department, a classmate of Oswald's, and the man who actually recruited Oswald into the Civil Air Patrol. As a witness before the Warren Commission, O'Sullivan swore falsely, saying that there was no moral record on Ferry in the New Orleans Police Department Vice Squad. That's false. I got copies of some of them. We took Philip, apparently by prearrangement, to the home of an uncle in Jefferson Parish. And once they crossed the line into the next parish, Garrison was without jurisdiction. They kept him at the home of the uncle for a week and questioned him extensively, ultimately tape recording.
Who took him to the uncle?
Oh, Sergeant Bourne and O'Sullivan.
And the uncles was Gervasi's uncle?
Yes. I don't know on which side of the family. There came a point at which they take the quarter. And they gave them to understand, and they said, and that's how they gave them to understand, that they were working for Garrison and trying to keep everything on the QT. I'm sure, from what I learned from the boy, that he never did realize what they were driving at. But they emphasized some things to attract attention to that and to distract him from what really interested him. But they kept him there for a week. That's a very unusual thing. He was still only a kid, just out of high school. O'Sullivan becomes very interesting because he wasn't very civilly because he did recruit out of because he did mislead the Warren Commission. Well, I should have gone. Let me tell you about Philip and his father. Philip hated his father. He did everything he could to drive his father crazy.
Did he?
One of his tricks was to refuse to touch a doorknob that his father had handled. He'd use a handkerchief. Put the handkerchief over the doorknob and then handle the doorknob. They finally committed Philip to the Mandeville Mental Hospital. It was not a fenced in room. And Philip was there for a while. I've forgotten how long. When he came out, he ran away from home. He went up to Mississippi. He came back, and he visited Grindier while he was away, from home. A young woman I know who was going to be his age met him, ran around with him while he came back, including to bring years. So my knowledge of the Marsh Marauders and of the handkerchief and doorknob was running away from home. It comes initially from the Jefferson Parish Juvenile Reports. And they were after it. The story Philip told the Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office is that he had a homosexual experience under compulsion and initially without being aware because he was drunk at the cheap clubhouse known as the Silver Dollar. When Gervasi came back from Mississippi and was hiding from his parents, that Noble Grindier did not call up the parents. He put arranged for Philip to have a bed at the Silver Dollar. I found out from Philip, voluntarily on his part, that he was not unwilling on his part no more than that was involved. And I don't know if this shocked his mother or not. But that was on that occasion that he said this. Now, Ricardo Davis had a camp that was more disguised for getting money for no good reason, allegedly for Cuban causes, on the north side of Lake Pontchartrain. They had about 20 people there. Some of them came from Miami. There was nothing about it that wasn't a fiasco. I had a long chapter on this in Oswald and Orleans, and for some reason or the other thing, they decided to take that story out, including all the documents. But this place was close to the place that was raided where the explosives were. Davis told me that he got a warning at night to disband the camp. That if he didn't, it would be raided. And it could have been raided at any time. I spoke to the St. Tammany Parish Sheriff's Office lieutenant who was in charge of that. He was a very cooperative man. One night, he was to three different camps. I mentioned two. And I know nothing of my own knowledge of the third one. There's a fourth one of which I ran that had no connection with the others. The fourth one was a small one, a six-man big tent in a state forest along the shores of Lake Pontchartrain. And I found this out in the course of tracing down the Ricardo Davis story. I found a young woman who used to date Ricardo Davis. She worked in a Dairy Queen not far from that camp, toward the Covington area, rather than toward the causeway. She told me that Davis asked her to go with him when he went out to the camp. And they had just gotten off the main road when he pulled out a pistol and gave it to her and said, "Hide this, we may need it." I told her to put it between her legs, but it wouldn't be seen if the car was stopped. She was terrified. And of course, she could have been ruined if that gun had gone off and on the bumpy roads. They have shell roads over there. They don't have gravel. They use shells, crushed shells. And they get pretty bumpy. So, Davis told me, in effect, that this woman was scared, that the CIA had told him to close up the camp. He didn't say that. He said it was not the FBI and it was the Washington people. He broke up the camp. There were two of the men that didn't get away with the rest of them. And Grenier pretends that he gave them money. I think it was $20, or $20 each, for bus fare back to Miami. But that wasn't his money. He just makes on it was. He got it from Carlos Quiroga, Q-U-I-R-O-G-A. Carlos Quiroga put up the money. Grenier took the credit for being a decent man who put up the money. Grenier gave him a check. Quiroga gave Grenier the cash, and Grenier gave the men the check. That's the way I understand the story.
And you sent him the silver dollar?
I think those two stayed there.
Uh-huh.
Yes. I think it was for overnight. Well, the silver dollar was cheap and close to Grenier. It doesn't have to have any further meaning than that.
I understand. It just the name of it just stuck in his plane. Old dilapidated hotel. Since it had a fire, you know.
Two fires that I know of. Two of them.
Two?
Yeah. Second one was more serious. That's in the French Quarter.
Yeah.
Not far off Decatur.
Could you, on a map, locate where those training camps were?
Only in general.
You think
they were between Macomb and, I forgot the name of the other place, L-A-C-O-M-B-E. You cross Lake Pontchartrain, and there's a main road that parallels it, that's off of those. I found this woman working in a gas station. I found her by accident, really. And her husband was the same parish, Tammany's Parish, Deputy Sheriff. I saw him, he was in uniform when I saw him. He came by the gas station. And not far from there, was a combination country store, gas station, and bar at a crossroads. And they sold beer. And this man sold the provisions to Ricardo Davis, and Davis would bring them in for beer.
Well, do you think this general story should be in the background, part of that, the Shaw chapter in Farewell America?
No, I see no relevance. Davis was using this as a means of raising money. He was pretending that these men were going to participate in the liberation of Cuba.
Yeah. What was the name of Davis's organization again? Do you recall? I know it's in New Orleans.
I think he was connected with what's his name, Batista. Mariano, I think. A Christian Democratic movement, maybe. Mm-hmm. Been a long time, I can't be sure. But it was a ripoff. It was a joke of a training camp.
When he told that girl that the Washington people told him to move, it was genuinely the Washington people? Or was it just a fake on his part?
He told me that.
Told you what?
That it was, I asked him, FBI, he said no. I said, another Washington agency? He said, yes, you can guess so. But I don't know if he's telling me the truth or not. But I have no reason to believe the FBI would have warned him.
H-O-U-M-A was a training camp in...
But it's Manastoma.
Homa.
Manastoma. I'm trying to think of anything that Jack Shaw and the CIA through those camps, I don't believe so.
How about Ferry?
That's not likely. I think I would pick it up in terms of specifics. He's a pretty conspicuous man.
Yeah. I don't, then Garrison pushing ahead with the Shaw trial would not necessarily have hit those, would he?
No, it wouldn't have been at all.
So the CIA's probably, or the intelligence operations would probably have been primarily.
I think there again the problem was one of possible prior connection and that leading back to the CIA.
Well, you know, you never mentioned the defense intelligence or the Office of Navy Intelligence and so forth.
Because they don't figure overtly in this. And as a consequence, we tend to forget them.
But yet when you look at the list of agents and the number of men and amount of money, they predominate in the...
NSA is far and away the biggest.
But why don't we ever hear that name or any people connected with them?
I think in part because they don't engage in the kind of dramatic exploits that we associate with the CIA. Theirs is a more sedentary function. They sit at best and they translate codes and things of that sort. After they intercept them, that is. So, if any of the training camps had been connected with the CIA, that would have been some embarrassment. There were also unconfirmed reports, and I don't believe them, that I had Oswald at the Ricardo Davis camp.
You mentioned Lillian Cohn's home where you did the taping of Philip Gervasi.
Yeah. They pronounce it Gervasi.
Gervasi.
It's spelled as though it should be pronounced Gerasi, but they call Gervasi. It Gervasi.
And when her home is on what street?
Broadway.
Broadway. Where at on Broadway?
It's between St. Charles and...
I'll find it in the telephone book.
Yeah, maybe under the name of Trent, Louis Trent. It's, if you're going from Canal Street, you go down to St. Charles and turn right on Broadway.
Mm-hmm. Fine.
Now, we had an encounter later over a very strange thing. I only tell you fact I'm not interpreting it. I will interpret some. It came a time when Nixon had a prior arrangement to speak at the Veterans of Foreign Wars Convention in New Orleans. And you may remember he lost his cool there and pushed Ron Ziegler around with cameras going. There was a whole hue and cry about a death threat against Richard Nixon in New Orleans. It got sensational attention, and it was fabricated. My belief is that it was done in great haste, because it was just too much, like too many other things that I remember from the JFK stories. As a result, I was able to tell a reporter from the National Enquirer, Paul Massey, this is nonsense, you're not going to get a story out of it. I'm going to tell you what else you're going to find out. You're going to find out that all of this is supposed to happen at the Waterbury Drugstore in Canal. That's what did happen. They picked up a cop who had put the cop in the turntable, I think it was in Arizona. His name was Gaudet, G-A-U-D-E-T. And they went after him in such a way as to frighten him. He took off like a scared deer, and there was considerable concern that he would be hunted down and killed. I don't know of any basis for suspecting that man or for arresting him, for holding him. I'm sure nothing happened to him. It was all fabricated. And somebody cooked up the idea that he was the person involved in the threat against Nixon, overheard in the Waterbury drugstore. It was almost word for word from Garrison's files and other stories about the kind of things that had earlier been reported by that drugstore. Lillian Cohen wound up as his lawyer, as Gaudet's lawyer. And the last I heard from her was when I told her that I could pinpoint the origins of each detail of the story, the JFK assassination story. So just a small world. But that poor Gaudet was badly abused. They could have killed him. It's a wonder they didn't. He was running for his life through the woods, and they were after him with high-powered rifles. They really consider him an assassin.
My God.
He'd become a flower boy.
Huh?
He'd become a flower boy. He lived in a commune in Arizona. He didn't want to be a poppy boy. But those kind of people were always marks for the cops. And very other living deaths like that. I guess not on that.
Sullivan lied to the Warren Commission because he knew what they wanted.
I think so.
And what they wanted was to keep the involvement of Oswald to a minimum in New Orleans.
I think they wanted to keep all suggestions of his having any connection with the official organization out of the record. I think they wanted to avoid anything that could be investigated and could lead one to that conclusion. That we had some kind of connection. But I thought it was strange that Lillian Cohen winds up as the lawyer for the ex-cop Gaudet.